Some of the topics in this episode are graphic in nature and may be disturbing to some listeners, especially children. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Marisol Nichols podcast. Today, we are so fortunate to have as our guest, Ori Freeman. Now, Ori is a human trafficking survivor. She is an activist, she is a mom, and she is an incredible person. Man, you guys are just going to love her. And we are so fortunate to have her on. And Ori, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and everything that you have been through. I hope that our listeners give you all the support that you deserve in this world. You are a phenomenon. All right, let's get started. Okay, so Ori, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I can't thank you enough, and I'm so blown away by you because you are inspiring. And you and I have very similar backgrounds, and we're probably going to get into it. But you, and I like to say, same with me, don't let that define who we are or what we do with our lives. I can't thank you enough for sharing your story, for coming on the podcast, for letting everyone know, because you are inspiring. And I'm so excited for this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's really a good opportunity.
If we can start with, you were born in prison.
Yeah. So my biological mom was fighting murder at the time. And she has her own testimony as far as like what she'd been through as a child. You know, she was raped at 9 years old, and my grandmother told her she must have liked it. And my mother started off her journey and her path. And by ended up running away and ended up being in prostitution as well when she was really young at 14 years old. My mother tells a story about how she, the first time she ever turned a trick, which is somebody purchasing sex, was she was literally in elementary school. She was in the fifth grade. It shows the generational trauma already and like the generational like cycle that had to at some point be broken, which thank God it was with me. And she ended up having me in prison because she was fighting a murder case. The crazy part about it is that I just recently found out, well, me and my mother was talking and she thought one guy was my father, but come to find out, my father is actually Hispanic. My mother's African-American, but my father was a purchaser. So he was a cab driver and he was one of her regulars. And so that's that part of the story, right? Came from a woman who was in prostitution and a man from who purchase sex from little girls. So, and I did not know my biological mom. I didn't know any of my sisters or anything like that. We were separated kind of at birth. And at 2 days old, I was handed over to the foster care system and I was adopted by my adopted mom and her name was Lorraine Freeman. So that's how I got the name Ori Freeman, which ironically, when I was born, I was born with no name. You know, my name was Baby Girl Pearson and I had a booking number literally that was tied around my ankle. Wow. And as I was, you know, sitting in the, and it might have been a couple of more days that I was in prison with my mom until she was released, until they could get me down to the regular hospital and then be adopted out. So my mom was a single mom. We were on welfare, lived in Section 8. My mother worked 3 jobs in order to kind of like provide for me, which was really not really jobs. She was really like keeping up the apartments in order to live there at the Section 8 buildings. Right. And Section 8 is kind of like a public housing thing. So it was literally 8 of us living in a 1-bedroom apartment, 416 square foot, literally. Concrete walls, wow. Like no air condition, not a lot of ventilation coming through. And growing up though, like I didn't know I was poor. Like I had no idea that we were poor. My mother did a really good job at making sure that I always was fed, made sure that I always had clothes on my back and the things that I needed. You know, I had a really good childhood. Like when I would honestly say, like from the ages to like the day that I was born up until probably about 5, up until like 8, I would say. But I come from right. A Black family that was like, we didn't talk about what happened inside of the home. Neither did we talk about our business outside of the home. So,
right.
And children were always separated from adults, like extremely. So my uncle being in prison or my auntie doing drugs, like they weren't in prison. They were in the army or, oh, my aunt was on a mission trip. Like, no, she was smoking dope, you know, like, but we didn't talk about the truth. So I grew up in the church, you know, I literally, sang in the choir. My mother was a deaconess. My grandmother sat in the front row every Sunday morning. I couldn't even eat a peppermint. And I had this really strong foundation of faith. I will say that. But my mother sheltered me throughout my childhood, you know, and I think a lot of that was like out of protection too. Like I grew up in a gang infested area, a lot of drugs, a lot of prostitution was happening at the time. But there was no honest conversation. I didn't know I was adopted. And I was living in this false family. like these lies that were being told consistently. Nobody ever talked about what happened when the street lights went off. Nobody ever talked about the vulnerable, the unseen, and, you know, the misrepresented in like in the world. Like, we didn't have those type of educational conversations. We didn't talk about the truth in our family. And my mother, honestly, throughout my years of healing now, she did the best she could with what she had, trying to break generational poverty, generational cycles of abuse. My adoptive mother comes from a generation of like the hush-hush generation. They didn't talk about when someone was abused or molested.
Right.
You didn't talk about those things, you know, and you kind of led it to the church. So
I understand. I so understand.
Now at 26 years old, I recently had my first memory of the first time I was ever molested was at 5 years old by a neighbor that lived in our building that used to make me and her son do sexual things. My mother was very private. So when I say I was sheltered, like I really want parents to understand, like when you shelter your kids, it doesn't stop them from being exposed to danger, exposed to bad people. You know, we have to make people aware and educate our children. Because of my experience, I can now educate my child. But that was the earliest memory at five. My life kind of started changing. I would honestly say in about the third, fourth grade, I started getting bullied really, really bad. So my mother had the opportunity to send me to either the local community school or a better school that was out in neighborhoods that was much more advanced, much more, the education was better, and brutally honest, more communities that was more wealthier than ours. And a huge big thing was I bounced back and forth throughout elementary from my local school to a private school. And the thing about it was that when I went to the local school, I felt like I belonged there, right? It was kids that had exactly what I had. Parents didn't have a lot of money, so it wasn't about all the things that we wore. It really was about our education and friendship. And then when my mother transferred me to the private school, I got bullied really badly. I was a very timid kid. Like, people that know me now would be like, you, Ori, was timid. Like, I was a very quiet kid. And very early on, I would honestly say around the ages of like 7 and 8, like, I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. You know, and I always was belonging to the outcast, to the kids that were the weird kids. I was weird. I wasn't around the popular girls. I couldn't fit in. And I literally hung out with like all the outcasts, like all the kids that like we all were different. Either we were adopted, foster care, and we didn't know that yet, but we were just different. And throughout my elementary school kind of years, around like 7 and 8, nobody, like my mother didn't really teach me about like self-defense or speaking up for myself. It was always about telling the teacher but not having a voice. So very early on, from the age of 5 and already 7 and 8, I'm starting to learn that I don't have a voice. When I was living in this one bedroom apartment, I had an aunt that was really, really close to me. She was like my second mom. She took me to school, taught me how to tie my shoe, taught me my timetables, because my mother had to work so much to provide. She was my safe person. I love that lady with all my heart. I would rather sleep with her in the bed versus my mom, you know, sleep with her on the couch than my mom. And I was very attached to her. Before the next kind of like abuse started at 8, a lot was happening. My aunt, I started to see things that I didn't understand. My aunt was on drugs. I didn't understand when we would go to hotels and pick her up, or the things I would see on the table were drugs. I didn't know that. I didn't know that going to see my uncle, he was in a rehab and that he had just done time. Like, and he had an addiction problem, or why he was stealing. Like, I didn't know what was going on as a kid. Like, imagine already not understanding what someone was doing to my body at 5, but now not really understanding why the adults were doing things around me. No explanation. I'm confused. Not understanding why people won't accept me and they won't love me. But I was looking for love so much and acceptance. I used to give these girls my whole lunch. Like, my mom would pack me a little lunch. Like, I would have my fruit snacks. Like, I didn't have to eat cafeteria lunch. And I would give my lunch away in order to pay someone for a friendship. Mm-hmm. Being bought already at a price for something. That was the condition I already was being, kind of like I was already doing that early on. And my aunt was like, Ori, how come you coming home hungry? Like, we pack you a lunch. And then she ended up going up to the school and finding out I was being bullied. But it just didn't help. My mother transferred me back to the local school. And it was just inconsistent, very inconsistent. You know, I had no stability outside of the home. And then we ended up moving. First, the first person that moved out, my mother ended up getting the opportunity to clean up another apartment. So when she would clean up the apartments and collect the rent, we got to move to another bigger unit. My aunt moved first, and because she was my safe person at 8 years old, I remember the first time I felt abandonment. She was moving to San Diego. She was getting cleaned up. She got a job. And I remember being in the streets, a strong memory, in the middle of the street, in the projects, and I was crying and screaming and holding on to her leg like, please don't leave me. Please don't leave me. And that's my first experience of abandonment.
Can you talk about what happened at 9.5 years old?
My life within 1 year time span, it flew to where my behavior started changing. When I was going to the private school, I remember the first time that I gave this fifth grade boy oral sex on the bus. I probably had to be about like 8 at the time. And I remember that. His name was Marcus, and I gave him oral sex. I remember being at this summer camp, 9.5. And I remember liking this boy that was 13 years old. And he started to like touch on me when I would play at the park, things like that. And I think I started recognizing at that age that love and acceptance attached to somebody physically touching you. I think that was the first time when I started acknowledging and recognizing that that's like thinking that's what love was. And I remember giving him oral sex. One day after, like, it probably was like around, I was almost 10 years old. I ended up going to the fruit truck. Like, we called it the fruit truck, but it was like these trucks that used to sell all these different snacks and stuff like that. And I went off to one, and I ended up going through like the alley and going through this building. And I seen this boy that I did think was cute. And they were all like inside hanging out. And I remember him like calling me into there. And you know, a part of you was kind of like, okay, oh my God, oh my God, he noticed me. Oh my gosh, he notices me. Right. And I go in there and I'm thinking like, I'm just going to kiss him, you know, and he ends up raping me with two other boys that were both, all three of them were gang members. But I remember the details. I remember him kissing me. I remember him touching me. And because of the things I've been exposed to already, I'm thinking like, okay, maybe this is what it is. This is what love is. This is what sex is. This is love. Like, this is sex. Oh my God, I'm going to have sex. I never had a conversation with my mom about it. My mom didn't even sign my permission slip to for sex ed about when a girl starts going through a menstrual. I was so very naive and just had these, if the parents are not teaching, the children will find out from somewhere else. And a lot of times 100%. It's the wrong mouths in the wrong way. And I remember telling him stop. And I was like, stop. I don't want to do this. And I remember him sticking his penis in me. And I remember he called the other two boys in there and they raped me. And I remember it getting later and later. And I sat into that laundry room. My mother was looking for me all over the place. I come back up to the park. It's almost dark. And I remember my aunt coming up there. She was in town. And I just remember not asking what had happened or are you okay? I remember being yelled at and screamed at and called fast. And I'm running off and what am I doing? I'm always trying to do something fast and targeted and being told that it was my fault versus being comforted as a kid. I was a child. I was only 9.5 years old. And I remember my mother was so upset that she ended up telling me I could go with one of my mentors who actually was a woman who worked at the park. And she became someone like a big sister to me because I was my mother's only adopted kid. She was somebody that was safe and I would hang out with, that she would let me go and kind of mentor me. And from that moment, I went to her house that night and then I told her what happened. And I remember that I was bleeding a little bit, but I remember so bad wanting to tell somebody that I wasn't even like bleeding anymore or anything. And I remember, I think I took some makeup or something and put it on my pants to like get her to notice, to ask me, because I couldn't say it. Like, that's how bad it was. And I remember her being like, what happened? And I just started crying and told her. And then, you know, I mean, it wasn't really blood, but like, I remember going to the hospital though, and he took the samples and all that stuff. And there was a case opened. And I remember having to, you know, say where he lived and things like that. But I remember being in that waiting room at the children's hospital. And I remember my aunt coming in there yelling and screaming. And my mom was just quiet. Nobody had asked me what happened. It was like, it was my fault.
I understand that.
Nobody ever asked, was that okay?
You know, you may or may not know a little bit about, I think we talked a little bit about this when I called you on the phone, but I know that assumption that a child will make when something like that happens. You know, it's pretty common knowledge now because I talked about it in an interview, but when I was 12, I was essentially raped by numerous guys at a party and everyone knew about it. I remember my mom blamed me. She said, that's what you get. I'll never forget it. That's what you get I think I was, that's what you get for drinking. I'm 12. First time I ever drank. I don't remember friggin', I remember like little flashes, but that was it. I passed out and everyone knew. And you and I have talked about this, but it's like when no one explains to you that it's not your fault, your assumption as a kid is it's you. It's your fault because it didn't happen to that girl or that girl or that girl. It happened to me. So I want you to know that I fully understand that conclusion that you make as a kid when something like this happens to you, if no one goes the extra mile to explain to you what's happening, you blame yourself. So I so understand that. I'm going to jump ahead to, there was something horrific that happened to you when you were 11 years old in court. Can you explain a little bit about this? Because I know this is sort of the impetus to you leaving home and then becoming trafficked. So I want to start sort of when you were 11 and what happened? Yeah.
Well, no, after the gang rape, I ended up, cases end up being open with DCFS in Los Angeles County. And it was completely different then. They were had a lot of lack of education and awareness, and the case was closed because there was no further evidence. So imagine, you know, you being 9 and a half and then no one believing you in anything or any justice not being served. The boy did go to camp. He went to juvenile hall for it and things like that. Multiple of them went to juvenile hall. I didn't have to testify or anything, but I remember nothing changing in my home. And then after that, I remember, I didn't mention though, but my mentor, the girl who else I went to, her boyfriend, I remember him forcibly raping me. Like, he literally shoved my mouth and started making me give him oral sex at 10 years old. So my abuse started continuous. Like, every man that I came across couldn't keep their hands off me. When I was about 10 and a half years old, almost 11, literally, I think I probably was 11, like right at the beginning when I turned 11 years old, I ended up finding I was adopted, which was something that was really, really kind of like a tip of the iceberg for me after the molestation, after the gang rape, after all this abuse that I'm experiencing, not feeling like I belong anywhere and all the lies that were told to me. Finding out I was adopted kind of was like the tip of the iceberg. And I just became extremely, extremely just a different kid. You know, I was never disrespectful to my mother. I love her. I loved her. And I knew that she loved me, but I just didn't have any care. Like, you know, started running away. And I wouldn't say I was running away already at 11. I was testing the waters very young. Like, you know, yeah. Street lights. Come on, when the street lights get off, I'm going to come home 2 minutes after the street lights. You know, don't go up the hill and around the corner. Now I'm going 3 blocks around the corner, you know, because there was just these lies that I felt like, what do kids do? You don't run away to something, you're running from something. And I was willing already at an early age to run away from myself. And I didn't want to be nowhere near anybody that would harm me. And at 11 and a half, I ended up, how I got in the system was, my behavior started to change. And after I found I was adopted, I ended up catching my first juvenile case, which led me to juvenile probation. And I was at school. I went to a really, really, really rough school, literally in the sixth grade. I was 11 and a half, almost 12. And because the way my birthday fall, and I was the youngest in my class, and I got to the school and they had really bad racial tension against African-Americans and Hispanics, like really bad racial tension, riots all the time, blacks against Hispanics in Los Angeles. And I ended up getting caught up in a riot after school, though. And I got into a fight with a girl and I was angry. And I remember the girl, and I never really tell this part of the story, but I remember picking up a skateboard and hitting her with it and hitting this girl with it and continuously hitting her. And I ran, got on a bus, I remember laughing and like felt this power of like all my friends, everything, all this stuff, right? And I remember coming back to school the next day and the police were there and they said I had put this girl in the hospital, things like that. And I was going to be charged with assault and battery. And I ended up going to court and I was placed on these probation terms and it caused a really huge problem in my family. I started kind of like not really running away, but kind of trying to run away, like not coming back or coming back late. And then it all started, a shift happened. When I was still on probation, doing my community service, and I met this girl, and she became my friend. And I always give people a description because I think it will help, especially minorities, that like how kids are drawn to people that have more than them or are pretty. And we're living in a society that do that now. Like, I'm going to follow her because she's cute. Like, and it was this girl, green eyes, pretty hair, mother owned a home. Had a mom and dad, had a grandma. Mom was a head nurse. Dad was like, worked in like, you know, the government kind of stuff. But she had this huge house in the middle of the hood.
Wow.
And she used to hang out at the library. So all it took was a hello.
How old is this girl?
So I was 11 and a half, almost 12. And Cece was about 13, going on 14.
Thank you. Okay.
She's a couple years older than me.
Okay.
She was exposed to, like, she was smoking weed, you know, one of that cute popping girls, right? Like, had the pretty hair, had the gold jewelry on, like, had the fresh Dunks and the Jordans and was fresh water crop tops. Everything as an 11 and a half year old girl, you're like, I want to be like her.
Right.
I want what she has. You know, going to her house sometimes. So then I start ditching the library, right? So now I'm hanging out with her kind of like, oh, I only got to do 4 hours today. Bye. And now I'm hanging out in the neighborhood. And it's funny because a guy who really changed my life, who really was helping me when I was a kid, an older male, who really set his boundary and never wanted sex from me or anything. He brought this up the other day. He said, man, it was like when you was 11 and a half before you, somebody was pimping you out. Like, it was like, it was coming. Like you would always run into men. It was like, I hate to say it. It was like, it was destined to happen. Because I remember going with her to a house that was like a dope spot. And this guy was, he was fine. I thought he was cute. He was older, in his late 20s. And he was a pimp. And going into this house, like, full of pimps. Like, it was full of pimps. And, like, he was into me. And, like, it was like, he was trying to get me to be trafficked. He was trying to pimp me out. But it was like, it missed the mark. Like, I would leave. And then it was like, then we would go somewhere else. And it would be pimps. And it was like, it was bound, almost bound to happen. So then one day, I'm at home. And I remember, I don't really tell this much. I remember trying to run away for the first time. Because I found out my mom had a new friend, right? And that fear kicked in about, is this is going to happen again? And I'm not going to let this happen. He ain't going to touch me, right? So I would leave or, like, try to leave in the middle of the night, that kind of thing. And I remember running up the street one day to this young boy's house. His name was Sergio. Still remember this little cute Hispanic boy. He snuck me through his window, and I remember almost getting ready to have sex. I remember that feeling again of laying on my back, though. It just was normal. Like, at 11 years old, rape was normal to me. Abuse was normal. Chaos was normal. Instability was normal. Like, that was my normal already growing up as a kid, laying on my back or being forcibly raped. That was normal.
Right.
It's nothing that you could tell me that other people wasn't going through it. I just didn't meet nobody yet that had came out on the other side. It was like everybody was doing it. Oh, that's normal. Little girls having sex with older guys. That's normal. You know, guys want to touch you. Mom's boyfriend want to kiss you and lick you and have sex with you. That's normal. And I remember coming back down the hill. My mom was so, so mad. And our relationship was getting really strained. And I remember coming down. And then the guy was there. Well, he tried to come in the house. And it was the guy who had molested me. And I remember her, like, talking to him outside. I do remember her being like, you know, it's not a good time to be here, da-da-da-da. And I felt so full of rage. Like, I wanted her to react as a mama bear. I wanted him to beat him with a bat, pepper spray. Like, I wanted him to react. Wanted her to react to this. And I remember just feeling really, really, like, just unloved. And I left. I decided I was going to leave that night. I was going to run away. So I called my friend Cece up. I was like, I'm about to run away as soon as my mama go to sleep. And, you know, I wasn't that bold to walk out the front door. I ain't gonna lie. I still had a little bit of respect. Like, I was sneaking to do it because I didn't want to hurt my mom, you know, but I wanted to leave. I didn't want to be there no more. And there was also parts of me that I was looking to be accepted into this world that I had no idea. I remember one thing I will say, my mother used to always tell me, like, hard head makes a soft ass, baby. Like, she didn't say ass, she said butt. Like, hard head makes a soft butt. And the streets don't love you. The streets will tear you up and spit you out. And it was already this like dopamine that was like already in me because it was like, I'm already experiencing it. Oh, well. And I remember running away that night. I ran about, like, literally I lived on West Adams, and she lived probably about like 10 blocks. Like, I mean, a good 3 miles. And as a kid, you don't even think now until I'm driving, like, dang, I walked that far. At 11 and a half, I was walking at 2 o'clock in the morning. Like 1 o'clock in the morning, like walking, no fear, not nothing. That I think about that kind of stuff too. And I walked to her house. I got to her house. She's like, hey. Like, she opens the door. She's like, my grandma sleeps. And I'm like, did you tell her I was coming to spend the night? She was like, yeah, but I told her you was coming earlier. Like, you was already here. So we got, I got in there, got in her room. And I remember looking in her room like, man, like, you got your own room. Like, you got all these clothes. Like, she had everything, everything that I didn't have. And she was like, you got to change your clothes. And that night, I still had on my school uniform. I hadn't got out of it, nothing. I just slipped on my pants. I had on my school khaki uniform. I had on my Tuesday or Wednesday panties that my mom, she didn't buy me Victoria's Secret at no 11 years old. I wasn't getting no Target panties. My mom bought me the panties that was in the pack, and she bought me the undershirts that still had the little ruffle on it that had the little color stream. Mm-hmm. I had that. She's like, you got to take that off. You can't wear that. I'm like, where are we going? I thought we were just hanging out. She's like, no. We're going to go chill with my boyfriend. Let's go smoke. Let's go smoke some weed. Like, I'm like, all right. She puts on these clothes. I put on this t-shirt that had like some graphic on it, some shorts. Mm-hmm. Cold as it was, I think I put on her shoes or something. She took my my mother used to have me in these ponytails. Like, she used to have these like photos. I mean, these ponytails in my head. And she took them out. She unraveled them, took the ballies off, the barrettes kind of, and then pushed my hair in a ponytail, like in a poofy ponytail. And I was like, whoa, like this makes me look older, right? And then she was like, remember, you're not 11, you're not 12, you're 15. Remember that. I was fully developed to, like, I started my period at 9 years old. So, like, you know, it doesn't change, though. I was a kid.
Right.
And I remember we left, got to this house. We walked about, like, 6 blocks, man. Like, it was still far. Like, we still walked far. Like, had no – we are 11 and 13, 14 walking in the middle of the night, right? And we get to this house, and it's in the back of this apartment building, and it reeked of – I now know it was crack. Like, it was dope. And got to this house. There was a guy on the couch, and he probably was in his like late 20s, early 30s, probably. Still don't remember how old JB was, but a woman in the kitchen cooking. And we got into this room. It was just a regular chair, like a papa chair, sitting there in this raggedy couch and a glass table. And on the glass table was a gun, was drugs, and his weed. And he was rolling up. And I remember coming in, and she was like, what's up? Like, she was like, he was like, what's up, Cece? And he was like, who's your friend? And she was like, oh, this is my friend. I think my name was Brittany or something else. Brittany again. It was another name. And I remember him just looking at me. And I know that look. And I just smiled back. It's like I already was conditioned already. I knew it. And her boyfriend came, and he pulled up. He came inside. He came inside, and he was a lot older than her. He probably was about like 17, 18 years old. And he came in the house, and she was like, you want to go smoke? Let's go hotbox. And I was like, no, I don't think I really want to hotbox. You know, it's just the environment did. Something in your gut as a kid, you still feel like something's not right.
Yep.
Something's not right. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to hotbox. I don't want to be too high to where I can't be aware. And still that fear of being raped. You know, it's that fear that comes back. And I remember sitting on the couch and him looking over at me. He had the blunt in his hand. He looked at me and he was like, what you doing out so late? Where your mama and your daddy at? He like, you shouldn't be out this late. Like, where your parents at? And I was just start crying. And I told that man my life story. It felt like 30 seconds. I was adopted, how I was molested, how I was abused, how nobody wanted me. I didn't know who I was. My mother. And he was smoking, and he just looked at me. He's like, you're going to be straight here. You decide to stay here, you're going to be straight here. Ain't nobody going to hurt you here. And I remember felt this sense of, like, safety a little bit.
Right.
Because it's normal, right? It wasn't nothing. It was like a red flag. It's normal.
Right. Somebody's there. Somebody's listening. He's listening to you. He's giving you sympathy. He's understanding. He's
the first person at 11 years old. Yeah. The first person at 11 years old a child is in contact with is saying, that's fucked up what happened to you.
Right.
Right? Like, how, imagine that, feeling that comfort, not from your mother, not from a coach, not from a teacher, not a doctor, not the nurse that took the samples, not anybody.
Right.
And this is the stranger is the person that's telling you, a perpetrator telling you, you're going to be straight here. Ain't nobody going to touch you here. Like, to feel a sense of protection, to feel safety. And I remember he smoked and he was like, you want to smoke? I was like, I'll smoke a little bit. And I smoked a little bit. There was nothing odd that I was 11 and he was in his 30s.
Right.
Nothing at all.
Right.
Nothing. I remember, like, I got to use the bathroom. Like, I'm going to run to the store real quick. He was like, go use the bathroom in the back. And I walked to the back of the room, and there was a small little room. Like, so it was a small bedroom, one apartment, not even probably 400 square foot, but it was a beautiful woman. She was like Hawaiian and like Asian and Hispanic, like all mixed, beautiful woman. She sat on the bed cross-legged and she was doing something on her phone. And I walked in the back and I was like, hi. And she didn't speak to me. So then at that point, you know, my mouth was kind of a little bit more like ruthless stance. So I was like, all right, bitch, like, and went to the bathroom. When I came out of the bathroom, he was talking to her and then she spoke to me. So he had given her permission. And this was the start of my grooming process. And she's like, you know, I wasn't really trying to overhear your conversation. I said, but you were. That was being nosy. She's like, excuse me. And she was like, I'm just saying, like, you were being nosy, kind of. And she said, but I was raped by my father my whole childhood. And then my stepfather that my mother chose to get started sexually abusing me, too. So I know what it's like. That's how I came to California. And she was like, but you're going to be good here. We like a family here. JB, don't let nothing happen to me. I was like, well, I wasn't just, like, trying to stay or whatever. And I remember coming out the bathroom and just talking to her then and opening up about things, talking and looking around the room. And she had all these clothes, once again, right? Everything. And I only shared it because people like, why would such a materialistic thing? Because when you don't have nothing, even the poverty mindset still today in today's culture, you want what somebody else has. Right. And that's the reason why celebrities, influencers get the amount of people that they have, because they have access to what other people don't have. Mm. You know? So if people could influence an adult, they can influence an 11-year-old child.
Absolutely.
So I was in her room and didn't know all this stuff was stolen, you know, or like however they got it.
Yeah.
And I was like, so what do you do? Like, why are you getting dressed up? And she was getting really pretty, like putting on this outfit. And I'm like, where are we? Like, where are you going? And she was like, well, I'm going to work. And I'm like, work at 1 o'clock.
Right.
Now my time is a little off because it had to be like 9 when I left, 1 by the time. And she's like, yeah, I just came from work, but I'm about to go back to work. And I'm like, where do you work at? And she tried to give the nice, glamorous escort, or try to empower me to say that she took men on dates and that's how she redefined her feminine power, mm-hmm. right? This is what she was telling me back then. I'm like, oh, okay, but what is that? And she's like, prostitute. I'm like, oh, prostitution. No. You like a hoe. That's what you are.
You said this at 11.
I don't want to do that. Yeah, I was like, oh, you're a hoe. Like, hoe. Like, hoeing.
Wow.
Yeah, like, I'm like, oh, that's hoeing. Like, oh, Wiz, I didn't say prostitution. I'll tell you back. I was like, that's, oh, you're like hoeing. And she was like, no, prostitution. I was like, okay. And I was like, oh, I'm not here for that. And I remember him coming in and JB had this, he had the cigar in his mouth and he had this little plastic black bag. And he was like, you want to take a bath? Like, I know that you want to. And I was like, yeah, cool. Yeah. Because I was like, had her clothes on. You know, I wanted to get out of her clothes. And I remember him coming in and bathing me. It felt good to be bathed, like to be soothed, for someone to pay attention to me. And I remember like being in the tub and like kind of like covering up my body. And he'd be like, your body is beautiful. You're exactly made how you're supposed to be made. And it's beautiful. It's worthy. Like, you know, it can also be like, he didn't say bought at a price, but he like, people pay thousands of dollars, you know, and I'm sorry that people did that to you, but you know, they didn't know your worth. They didn't know your worth. They didn't know your worth. Mm. And I remember him, I just remember him bathing me, like, and it felt good. And I got out the tub and I never really told this in detail. Like, I don't really tell stuff like this in detail when I'm telling my story, you know, but like, I just remember him caressing me, like, you know, and me desiring him at 11 and a half, like wanting to be in this family, this false family. And I remember I got dressed and I had on these plaid shorts that was green, black, and white, and a white beater, that was green, and these bamboo kind of sandals that had the thongs that you would buy from the beauty supply. And I had like this little bitty thong that you could tell was like bought at some chonquito store. That's what I call them, like a little store or whatever. And I remember putting it on, like a thong, and I was like, oh my God, it's a thong. And he was like, don't worry, you'll never have to be out there like her. Hey, it's already trying to turn me against her kind of in a way. And like, you my princess, like you gonna be like, you my pride, you gonna be my prized possession. Like, that's what he's telling me. So we get in the living room, we go out, and then she tells me these rules. She's like, I'm gonna just tell you some rules. Don't ever sit in my front seat. I bought this car, I paid for this car. You feel me? Like, I make sure daddy is good. And I'm like, daddy, you call it daddy? Like,
right.
And not really understanding that this is my grooming process. And I'm like, all right, like, I guess. But it kind of felt good, like daddy in a way. He didn't have sex with me that night, but I remember going out to the track that night in Los Angeles to Long Beach Boulevard. And I watched this woman get out the car. So mind you, this is the first night. So I watched her come back and forth to the car and she was handing him money and stuff. So we start talking, he's smoking, and he's telling me kind of about the game. And we a family and we look out for each other. And, you know, she making sure we good and we straight and how we fed. And in exchange for that, you know, I make sure she's safe and I love her and I make sure that she feels good and all this stuff. I make sure that we provided for, we got a roof over our heads and all this stuff. And I'm like, but I don't want to do that. He was like, and he just didn't say anything. And I remember coming back to the car and him telling her that I was going to go with him, kind of. And I just remember crying and being scared. And I got out the car because you follow instructions. You know what to do. It's kind of already in you now. You know, it's been ingrained in you. And I remember walking down Long Beach Boulevard. A white pickup truck came, a four-door. And it was a Hispanic man. And he spoke to her in Spanish. She spoke back. And we got in the car. And I remember like a two-for-one special kind of thing, basically. And at 11 and a half, I watched this woman give this man a blowjob. And I'm in the back seat crying, shaking. He starts speaking her in Spanish, like yelling. His tone is loud. And he basically is like, get out the car. Get out, get out, get out, you know. And they exchanging words and get out the car. And I remember just crying. And she was like, suck it up. Like, you won't survive out here like that. You got to grow up and grow up immediately or you're not going to survive. And it was this look of fear in her face, like fear. Fear, hopelessness that I had seen, that I didn't see at the house. And we got back to the car, I was crying, and JB just, he hit me and dragged me out the car. Like, he literally, like, hit me in my face, dragged me, got out the car, pulled me out, dragged me down Long Beach Boulevard. And I remember him just saying things, like, snatching me up afterwards and being like, you think somebody love you? Look at everything that them people did to you. Look what them men did to you. Don't you want to get paid for this? Don't you want to take your power back? Like, he was very manipulative, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was just like, this is for your own good. Like, this is how you're going to survive. Like, nobody's going to look for you. Ain't nobody going to look for you. Your mama gave you up. Like, your mama ain't looking for you. I guarantee you, if you go home right now, she's not going to want you. And that night, I knew what it was like to be raped 7 to 15 times a night. I know what it was like to lay on my back.
That night?
And be numb. And every single moment, a piece of me died. Yeah, I turned like 7 days that night. And we went from the track, then we got a hotel, then two guys came in a hotel. And I knew what it was like to be numb. And I knew that even through my body, my physical body, like, how did these men not know that I was a child that was laying down with me? And I knew what it was to now pay a man for what had just happened. I gave him my money. And I remember that night, him holding me and her, like, I laid in front of him, she laid in back of him, like, and that still felt normal. And I remember him taking me home the next day. And I remember in my window, there was a lock in my window. And then my mom had put a brown bar in the window. Like, basically, so I couldn't get back in. Oof. And I remember coming back to the car and he was like, told you. Oof. I was out there for a couple of days. And because of my conditions of probation, my mother had reported to the probation officer I was gone. So there was a warrant out for my arrest. I had a court date. I missed it. I was out there for like 2 weeks with JB, in and out of motels, in and out of hotels. This is what's happening, you know, going back and forth to Long Beach Boulevard, foot fig, in and out of different motels, you know, posting ads. She's posting the ads. And then when someone would come there, she would like negotiate for them to have sex with me and pay. And so I didn't post ads when I was young, you know, she would post them and then she would just negotiate. And I remember that I got pulled over. It was late at night. I was in East Los Angeles and the police pulled us over. She kind of ran because she knew at this time, law enforcement was still able to pull over youth and for truancy, like not truancy, for late night curfew. Like, why are you out at 1 a.m? And I remember I froze. Like, he had gave me a name to tell, everything. And in the process of like 2 weeks, you're taught how to talk, how to walk, what to say, how to do it, how to eat, how to sleep, how to breathe, what you gonna wear, how you gonna have your hair. And it was like, I rapidly, a growth spurt within 2 weeks. Like, this girl that had a ponytail, bushy eyebrows, now had them waxed, now wearing nails, now wearing extensions, Jesus. Now having heels, having hardly anything on. And I remember the police asking me and I couldn't give him. He was like, kid, what is your name? What is your real name? Because I gave a name and he was like, this is not a real name. And I froze. And I gave him, he said, you have a warrant out for your arrest. And I remember them picking me up. They didn't pick me up for solicitation or anything, but they picked me up for the warrant. And I remember going in there and I went to Sylmore, California, because at the time that was Barry J. Nordoff Juvenile Hall up in the valley. And see, Los Angeles County at the time, over 10 years ago, they didn't have really a lot of young kids that were being incarcerated. It was only 16, 15-year-olds, probably some 14-year-olds. I was the youngest at the facility with another young girl who was 12. And she was there for trying to burn down her mother's house, like her foster parents' house. Not like that, but like she was in there. I think it was her mom and dad. She tried to burn them down, but she was being molested and stuff. She tried to burn the house down. So she had some mentor stuff. And I remember, like, it was so overpopulated. We slept in these boats in the rec room, in the dining hall, because it was filled. I remember coming and banging on the thing, like everybody looking to see who was the new girl coming in. And that was my first time in juvenile hall. And now I'm 11 and a half. I think I turned 12. I turned 12 in juvenile hall. And I remember being surrounded with girls now that was in prostitution, like, and girls who had committed robbery, burglary, girls I was in the shoe that was fighting murder, getting ready to go to YA. Like, I was now exposed at 11 and a half now to a whole new world. And then I sat in juvenile hall at 11 and a half for 3 months. And I kept coming back to court. I kept coming back. And I had an amazing judge. Her name was Judge Sloan. And she actually emailed me the other day. She was at someplace and seen me in a magazine.
Wow.
And reached out and said, man, my oh my, how tables were turned. But she was my judge for years. And she knew. So let me not go there. But at the time I went into court, my mom never came to court. And she was like, I'm looking for the kid's mom. She was appearing when I first was placed on probation. Where is Miss Lorraine Freeman? And in the third month, after my 12th birthday, the probation officer of the court stood up and said, I spoke with Miss Freeman and she no longer wants the child in the home. And when you hear that at 12 years old in that courtroom, that you're not wanted anymore by a family that signed up to adopt you, it was just like another tip of the iceberg. And I remember being in court crying. I just want to go home. I just want to go home. Mm-hmm. I remember calling her, blowing up her phone, her not answering, like, please, please, I'll be a good kid. I'll be a good kid.
Oh, so not. Oh.
And then I was sentenced to 6 months. I was given back to the system. And because the system was different, I wasn't placed on foster care. I was going to be on probation until my 18th birthday. That mean I would never be eligible to be adopted. I had to stay in group homes. And anytime I violated, anytime I had a fight, anytime I did anything wrong, I would go back to juvenile hall. And my life became a revolving door from 11 to 18 inside the juvenile system. And it's so much in my lifetime that those people became my family, and that's the redemption part of my story.
Wow. Okay. I want to stop here as it's a ton to digest. Ori, I'm really looking forward to hearing your redemption story. And we are going to pick up with Ori, part two, next week. In the meantime, Ori, thank you so much for sharing so much of your story and what you've been through. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You are amazing.